Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Star Wars Solo Command, Book 7 of the X-Wing series by Aaron Alston. Naval Lieutenant Jart Ahen looked rested and cheerful. The fact that he had only 12 minutes to live would have changed the Twi'lek's disposition, but he did not possess that knowledge. An aide, a human female, approached him and saluted.
I hope you enjoyed your leave.
Oh, certainly.
I wanted to let you know you had a communication from your wife come in a few minutes ago. It was flagged as urgent.
Ahen nodded thanks and headed for his quarters. What could be the trouble? He barely left her after spending his entire leave with her. But he frowned, trying to recall just how they'd spent their time together. He had the nagging feeling that something important was slipping by him. At his quarters, he brought up his personal terminal and opened his mail. There his wife sat before their terminal at home, and she looked distinctly unhappy. She glanced over to the side as though consulting with someone outside recording range.
Jack,
she said.
Those mortals are dancing in the parlor again.
Ahen switched off the message, not bothering to hear it in its entirety, and erased it. He retrieved his personal sidearm, a small but powerful blaster pistol, tucked it away in his pocket, and departed. Two beings sat facing each other across a hollow table.
In terms of pure strategy, there was nothing of particular interest between the capital ships in the Mon Ramonda Iron Fist fight.
The speaker was a Gamorrean, one of the pig-snouted humanoids known for their warlike dispositions, but almost nothing but his appearance characterized him as a member of that species. He was speaking basic, which was beyond the capabilities of other Gamorreans. And his voice was not a natural one. His words emerged twice, once in a throaty babble that sounded like gibberish to most people, and once in a mechanical tone from an implant in his throat. Two, he was the only Gamorrean known to wear a New Republic Fleet Command uniform. The being the Gamorrean addressed was also unusual, though his kind was certainly well represented in the ranks of the New Republic military. Admiral Akbar was a member of the Mon Calamari species, humanoids with fish-like features and rubbery skin. Though there were many Mon Calamari serving the New Republic, few had combat maneuvers named for him, or had designed fighter craft as Akbar had.
So you find nothing of interest in the engagement?
Admiral Akbar's voice was low, gravelly, slightly more imposing than the standard for his species.
If you will forgive me, I did not say that, sir.
The Gamorrean continued.
Mathematically speaking, there is much of interest in the behavior of the 181st. In addition to the fact that a demonstrably loyal Imperial elite squadron should not be working hand-in-hand with a rogue warlord like Zinj, there is something odd in the way they fight. Individual fighter pairs tend to respond with an interesting sameness to specific attack patterns.
The door into Akbar's office opened, and the admiral looked up as the naval officer entered.
Ah, Lieutenant Ahen, allow me to present Flight Officer Wurt Zabinring, also called Piggy. Zabinring, this is Lieutenant Jart Ahen, security detail.
Piggy rose to salute the naval officer.
Pleased to meet you, sir.
Ahen returned the salute.
Likewise.
Then he pulled his blaster from behind his back, pressed it into Piggy's stomach, and pulled the trigger.
It is remarkable,
Piggy thought, the suddenness of it.
One moment, perfect health. The next moment, perfect agony.
He could not see. The pain in his gut was so great, and he could barely hear. He knew he lay upon his back,
but couldn't remember getting there.
I think I have only moments to live. Interesting.
But the science that had altered him, giving him control over his emotions, had not done away with all of the biological imperatives that came with being Gamorrean. Another voice rose within him, growing louder.
Kill him!
Piggy tried to stand, but found that his shaky limbs were not making it an easy task. He saw Akbar slam into the assassin from the side, the webbed hands of the Mon Calamari closing around the Twi'lek's throat. But Lieutenant Ayan effortlessly wrenched Akbar's hands free and threw the Admiral against the wall. Piggy forced himself to his feet.
Time left. Estimated 10 or 12 seconds. Kill him.
Kill him. Kill him.
He walked, his feet unsteady, to Akbar's desk. He heaved, and it came up off the floor, so it nearly unbalanced him.
Good. I still have my strength.
He lurched into motion toward the assassin and dropped the desk so that it would not fall upon Admiral Akbar. When he regarded his handiwork, he saw that the Twi'lek's head was a quarter the width it should have been. A smashed mess that pleased one of the voices in Piggy's head, even as it appalled the other. Admiral Akbar was struggling to rise. He was speaking, but suddenly Piggy couldn't understand the words. The Gamorrean fell over backwards as the heat and pain in his gut spread out to overwhelm him. The enemy interceptor suddenly jittered in Wedge's sensor screen. He fired and saw the green flashes of three of his lasers connect with the interceptor's engines. The squint blew out of the sky, and Wedge jerked hard to port to avoid flying through the thickest part of the debris cloud. He switched his comm unit over to a general broadcast frequency and said, "Exercise terminated." The voice of Garrick Face Loren, one-time boy actor for the Empire and now New Republic flyer, came back.
"I'm not dead yet."
"You're protesting?"
"Not exactly, just curious."
The vista of the lunar surface faded abruptly to blackness. Wedge reached back to open the access hatch situated where the twin ion engines were in a real TIE interceptor and climbed out into overhead light. The room was a large one, crowded with tables, chairs, and simulator units. Across an aisle busy with human traffic, Face Loren dropped nimbly to the floor and looked curiously toward Wedge. Wedge waved him over. They were joined a moment later by two other pilots. Flight Officer Lara Knoxill, a lightly built woman with downy blonde hair, was possessed of a delicate beauty that belied her intensity and skill in starfighter combat. Captain Tycho Selku, a fair-haired man with features that suggested he'd weathered a lot of turmoil in his life, spoke first.
"Why'd you kill the Sim, Commander?"
"We were here to test the youngster's new combined unit tactic," Wedge said. "As soon as you and Lara went out, it became just another X-Wing versus TIE exercise. And," he checked the chrono strapped to his wrist, "we have about 10 minutes to get to our briefing." Most of the members of Rogue Squadron and Wraith Squadron were in their seats in the semicircular briefing amphitheater when Wedge entered.
"Commander Antilles, draw!"
Wedge turned at the sound of Wes Jansen's voice. The eternally youthful pilot, executive officer of Wraith Squadron, was on his feet aiming a datapad as though it were a blaster pistol, thumbing the transmit button with manic intensity. Wedge sighed and brought out his own datapad to receive the transmitted file. But Jansen's antics were a good sign. They suggested that the news Wedge was waiting for had arrived, and was good. En route to the main dais, he glanced at the Rogue Squadron executive officer, Nawara Ven, a distinguished-looking Twi'lek with brain tails arrayed artfully over his shoulders, and Wedge received a data file from him as well. He glanced over the two officers' transmissions as he stepped up behind the lectern, then looked up at the pilots before him. Two squadrons, nearly at full fighting strength, the best pilots he could assemble and train. He felt a rush of pride at what he'd managed to accomplish with these two units, at the level at which they'd managed to perform, but he kept it from his face. "I have mostly good news to bring to you today. First and foremost, Piggy's Abinring is responding well to Bacta treatment. He has regained consciousness, and all indications are that he'll enjoy a full recovery.
Unfortunately, we still have no information about the assassin's motive in attacking Akbar. The investigation is continuing. Second, the Mon Ramonda is within a day of leaving Repair Dock. By this time tomorrow, we'll be back in space and taking the fight back to Warlord Zinj. Mon Ramonda, the mighty Mon Calamari cruiser that was the flagship of the fleet commanded by Han Solo, had taken significant damage in its recent duel with the Warlord Zinj's own flagship, the superstar destroyer Iron Fist. But Zinj's forces had suffered far more. Third, and directly as a result of this, you all have one last leave coming to you. Report to the shuttle bay at 1500 tomorrow with your bags packed and all your affairs settled. Fourth, I have some changes to announce. The Wraiths have a new pilot for their roster. Targan, please stand. The new pilot was a Deveronian, grayish-skinned, with diabolic horns protruding from his forehead and fang-like teeth that would only cause appreciation in the heart of a carnivorous predator.
Flight Officer Elisar Targan, reporting for duty, sir.
Targan comes to us fresh from Fleet Command Academy. In addition to being a competent pilot, he's a medical corpsman. Once again, we'll have a unit medic. And unlike the rest of you, he hasn't yet had time to ruin his career or his mind. Then he won't do. That was Jansen. Send him home. Get us another lunatic.
Excuse me.
The Deveronian pilot hopped up to stand on his seat. He threw his arms back and chest out, posing like some superhuman hero from the most ridiculous of Face Lauren's holodramas.
Elisar Targan, Master of the Universe, reporting for duty.
Reg cocked an eyebrow at him. Interesting that a very junior officer would be willing to perform that sort of display in his first few moments with his new unit. Either the reputation of Wraith Squadron had convinced him that it was appropriate, or Fleet Command had found another mental case for his command. Wedge returned his attention to the pilot. Targan, sit. Pipe down, everyone. Fifth and last, there's going to be a little reorganizing to do within my squadrons. We'll be with Mon Ramonda on active duty. I've been put in command of the ship's four fighter squadrons. I'm also transferring back to and assuming direct command of Rogue Squadron, effective immediately. I'll still fly with the Wraiths, as well as Nova and Polearm, when circumstances and opportunities warrant, but I'm relinquishing day-to-day command. He saw the Rogues' good cheer continue, but the Wraiths sobered with the realization that their very best pilot was leaving them. Wedge continued, Lieutenant Lauren, attention. Face stood. Wedge said, This isn't a permanent promotion yet, so we're not going to do anything to you that will leave permanent marks. However, it is my pleasure to confer upon you the rank of Brevet Captain, which entitles you to command a unit such as Wraith Squadron. Congratulations, Face. As the applause died, Wedge said, That's it for now. Any questions? Yes, Wes. The Wraith's executive officer lowered his hand. The usual answer, too. We were lucky to get Face's X-Wing fully repaired. Wraith Squadron isn't getting any replacement X-Wings anytime soon. The Wraiths will continue flying mixed X-Wings and tie interceptors. Anything else? No? Dismissed. 30 minutes later, a quartet of Wraiths approached Face's quarters. Min Donos, a male Corellian, said, He just received a promotion of sorts. We shouldn't present him with a mutiny first thing. Dia Pasek, the female Twi'lek, said,
He insisted that he wasn't feeling well.
Lara Nutzel smiled over her shoulder at them.
He lied. He lies all the time, you know. This is the right thing to do.
She rapped on the door. From within came Face's voice. Yes?
May we come in?
I'm not decent.
When are you ever?
Lara opened the door and looked in. Face was lying on his bed, still in uniform, staring at the ceiling. Lara pushed her way in and heard the others crowd in behind her.
It's time to go out and enjoy yourself.
Face looked at her. Do I have to pull rank on you?
You only get to do that when it's appropriate. That's the unwritten law.
Face snorted.
All right. Where are we going?
Lara jerked a thumb back at her companions.
Since Elisar hasn't run up against Zinj or anyone but his instructors before now, We're going to take him to the Galactic Museum's new display on Imperial Intelligence. Give him an idea what he's up against. Then, we get a drink. Then, you and Min and Elisar give in to male biology and insult a bar full of soldiers, and Dia and I haul your battered bodies back to base. Face look helplessly at Donos and Elisar. You see what happens when we don't get involved in a mission's planning stage. The museum's displays on Imperial Intelligence were not, Donos decided, the one-sided history they could have been. The first displays on the tour gave details of the Old Republic's intelligence division, the secret police who were charged with protecting the Republic from subversion and treason. Farther along, the displays became more unsettling. As Palpatine took power, the intelligence division became a tool of terror and retaliation. Displays chronicled assassinations, kidnappings of Old Republic loyalists, tortures, subversions. One display showed the longtime intelligence head, Armand Isard, an aging man with an inhumanity to his eyes and features that were unsettlingly real, even in holographic replay. Farther down the exhibition, another showed his daughter, Isene Isard, nicknamed Iceheart, a tall and elegant woman of formidable bearing, and told of her swift rise to power through two simple tactics, turning in her own father for treasonous thoughts and attracting the eye of the Emperor. Now Iceheart was dead, killed by Rogue Squadron's own Tycho Celtul, and Donos knew the universe was better off without her. Instead of going out the exit at the end of the exhibition, the Wraiths turned about and went back the way they came, the better to give Targon a chance to view the displays.
Adalia?
The voice, wavery and uncertain, came from behind them.
Adalia Munasir, it's so good to see you.
Donos glanced back. Approaching them was an old man, his body so sparse of flesh that he seemed skeletal. But there was nothing menacing about the smile he was turning on Lara. Behind him, a dozen meters, but coming at a trot, was a middle-aged woman, her expression anxious.
Father, she called. Not again.
The old man reached Lara, seized her hand, pumped it vigorously.
Adalia, it's been so long. What have you been doing?
Lara tried unsuccessfully to extricate her thoroughly shaken hand.
Sir, I don't, I'm not... I'm so sorry.
That was the daughter.
He's confused. He doesn't always remember where he is.
Or when.
It's all right, Lara said, but she looked a little shaken.
The old man said,
Child, I must introduce Adalia Monasir, one of my best pupils.
Lara shook her head, and though she maintained a cheerful smile, Donos decided that it was forced.
I'm Lara, she said. I'm so sorry, the woman said. He was once with Old Republic Intelligence, so he likes to come here day after day. He was shot on a mission shortly after the Emperor came to power.
She indicated the place just in front of her temple.
He hasn't been the same since.
It's not a problem, Lara said.
Thank you for understanding.
The woman turned and trotted along in her father's wake. Lara turned and bumped into Face and Dia, who had returned during the conversation.
Whoops.
Face looked at her intently.
Gerwa Potunkin?
No.
Diplagon Ifrit?
Face, I'm going to shoot you. She pushed past him, laughing, and headed for the exit. Han Solo poked his head into Wedge's office. Got a minute? The general seated himself with characteristic casualness. I thought you ought to be aware of some scuttlebutt relayed to me by some friends on Coruscant. The intelligence investigation into the assassin who tried to kill Akbar is looking into the possibility of a widespread Twi'lek conspiracy. Conspiracy? To do what? They have no idea. Intelligence says there's a large warrior caste that resents the way the planet was dominated by humans for so long and hates the way Ryloth is regarded as a merchant world. Well, that last part is true. Well, General Kraken's people in intelligence have tracked some interesting behavior among Twi'leks on Coruscant. Like the assassin, Jart Ayan. He was on leave just before his attempt to kill Akbar. But apparently he and his family weren't where they were supposed to be. Where they were, what they were doing, nobody knows. Wedge returned Solo's gaze. You're leading up to something. You have several Twi'leks among your pilots. That's right. Caldera with the Rogues, Diapasic with the Wraiths, Nuro Twi'len with Polearm, Nawara Venn, my executive officer with the Rogues, is Twi'lek, as is one of my mechanics, Koyi Komat, for the squadron. How sure are you of them? Wedge thought back. His gut told him that they were dedicated pilots and technicians. I'm sure of them. Solo smiled. Good. He rose. I just wanted you to be aware of what was going on. Keep it to yourself, though, will you? And then he was gone. The man with the impossibly bland features appeared before Warlord Zinge's desk as though he were a hollow projection turned into flesh. I have a present for you, said General Melvar. Zinge managed to keep himself from jumping. Melvar, he knew, prided himself on his silent comings and goings, but Zinge had recently spent considerable effort to train himself not to start. He twirled one of his mustachios in a rickish fashion.
How delightful, he said.
The door into Zinge's office opened, and a pair of guards escorted in two people. Melvar gave Zinge a little theatrical bow. Allow me to present Drs. Nervin Bress and Edda Gast from our Special Operations Division of Binring Biomedical on Safalori. After due investigation, I decided to bring them to speak to you personally. Zinge folded his hands over the imposing swell of his stomach. He noted with satisfaction that his white Imperial Grand Admiral's jacket was spotless, nearly gleaming. It would be inappropriate to lead two doomed people before a shabby warlord. Ask them, Melvar said, about missing test subjects. Zinge gave him a blank look, as if struggling to recall something of little consequence, and then said,
Oh, yes. Doctors, tell me where a Gamorrean and an Ewok might obtain the necessary skills and temperament to fly starfighters.
Dr. Bress, the male, tried to catch the eye of his younger colleague. Dr. Gast ignored his attempt. She kept her gaze on Zinge.
Well, Bress said, they might have escaped from our facility.
Ah,
Zinge said. He picked up a datapad.
It says here that I sent out a memorandum asking about possible test subject escape some time ago, and that you replied in the negative. Correct?
Dr. Bress flinched.
Correct.
Zinge slammed the datapad down on the edge of his desk, snapping the device in two. Bress jumped. Interestingly, Gast didn't. Zinge modulated his voice to a snarl and allowed some color to creep into his face.
May I ask, why didn't you tell me then, when I sent out the memorandum? Why do I learn about it now?
Because we weren't sure, Bress said. We are not sure now.
Zinge stared at him a long moment, then turned his attention to Gast.
I'm not sure I understand this man. Perhaps you could explain a little more clearly.
I believe I can, she said. My uncle, Dr. Tuzin Gast, was also on this project, but he became rather too close to his test subjects. He developed real affection for them. Not a good idea, considering their intended use. One day, a couple of years ago, there was a tremendous explosion in Epsilon Wing. My uncle and several test subjects were killed. We reported the losses and continued as scheduled, although we discovered some interesting things about the accident.
Such as?
She began counting items off on her fingers. First, it was suicide. My uncle mixed some volatile chemicals in a purification tank and set them off. Second, most of the test subjects that had died were those who were the most changed by our treatments, the most violent.
The most promising,
Zinge said.
Yes, the most promising.
He deliberately brought them together so they would die with him.
You said most of the test subjects.
There was one exception, a Gamorrean. It had been through the intelligence series, but not the aggression series.
And this subject was supposed to have died in the explosion?
Yes, she said. But the only cellular material we found of it was blood plasma.
Which your uncle could have extracted from the creature and distributed prior to the explosion.
Yes.
Was there any blood plasma found of your uncle?
She shook her head. We found his head and several other parts.
What about Ewoks?
Two of the test subjects destroyed in the blast were Ewoks. We found body parts of two different Ewoks, so we had reason to believe both had perished.
Zinge took a long breath. Well, there's little doubt that Vort Sabinring, a rebel pilot of Wraith Squadron, is your uncle's pet Gamorrean. There is also reason to believe that Lieutenant Ketch, a pilot with a pirate group called the Hawkbats, is a similarly enhanced Ewok from the program.
He fixed Gast with an angry stare.
Your division has failed me, and blood must be shed if I'm to feel better.
He held out both hands, and the guards leaned in to place a blaster pistol in each. These Zinge set before the two doctors.
I'd be happy for you two to accomplish the task yourselves. That would save me some mental anguish, I assure you.
Bress, his voice climbing into a wail, said,
Please, sir, so much of the project's success is my doing. My mistakes have been so few.
Gast set the barrel of her pistol against her colleague's ribs and pulled the trigger. The sound of the blast filled the room, followed by the smell of seared flesh. Bress staggered sideways and fell against the office wall. Gast held up her pistol and allowed Melvar to take it from her.
Now, she said, will someone be killing me?
Zinge looked at her, forcing his expression into one of reasonability.
Or shouldn't we? You've been part of a team that has covered up critical errors in judgment. You couldn't even carry out a simple request to kill yourself.
She shook her head. Nobody asked me to kill myself. Your unstated request could have been that we kill one another.
Nor did you show enough courage to try to kill me when you had the chance.
At last, she smiled. A lopsided smile full of sarcastic cheer. Please don't insult me if you're going to kill me, too. I'll bet every credit I own that if I'd pointed that blaster at you and pulled the trigger, it would not have gone off. She leaned forward, and her smile evened out, became more genuine.
Well?
He regarded her steadily.
Well, you're correct in assuming that I didn't ask you to kill yourself. Why would I? You're blameless. Had you killed yourself or allowed Dr. Bress to kill you, you would have proven yourself to be stupid and blameless. But, fortunately,
that's not the case.
How would you like to do me a favor?
I'd like that.
Return to Sathalori. Dismantle the operation without letting anyone, and that means anyone at Binring, know you've done so. Send everything to Iron Fist. We'll consolidate the two laboratories. Set up the Binring facilities to detect and then annihilate anyone breaking in, because at some point, Vorcha Binring's squadron mates are going to get permission to return to the land of his birth. And that will be a good time to eliminate them. Setting all this up guarantees your continued employment within my organization. Each dead wraith brings you a sizable bonus. Deal?
Deal.
With her characteristic insolence, she extended him her hand to shake. When Gast, the guards, and the still-smoking body were gone, Melvar returned to stand before his warlord. He looked curious.
What?
Zinge asked. You've instructed her to kill all the wraiths. One of the wraiths is an unknown quantity. Gara Petafel.
I know. But since the mission to Aldivi went to pieces, she hasn't communicated. I'd be happy to arrange for her protection. She has to give me a reason first.
Understood.
And how goes Blunted Razor?
Every day we retrieve more tonnage of the wreck of Razor's Kiss. Melvar didn't add, and only you know why we're wasting all this energy gathering up the wreckage of a destroyed superstar destroyer. Zinge smiled.
Dismissed.
Flight Officer Lara Notso leaned in close to hear every word of the briefing, to see everything that floated on the holo projection. She hadn't always been Lara Notso. She'd been born with the name Gara Petafel, and had worn many others since her adolescent years. The delicacy of her features and build remained from her true identity, but little else did. She also hadn't always been a pilot with the New Republic's fleet command. Since her earliest years,
child of two of the Empire's loyal intelligence officers, she'd been groomed to be an officer of Imperial Intelligence. In that role, she'd infiltrated the lower ranks of New Republic Fleet Command, had transmitted vital data back to her Imperial controllers, and then to Admiral Apwar Trigget. She provided Trigget with information he'd later used to destroy Talon Squadron, an X-Wing unit led by Min Donos. And now, she fought beside the rebel pilots who'd once been her enemies. It had originally been a deception, another infiltration, but was so no longer. It was where she wanted to be, what she wanted to do. But she also fought against the growing certainty that someday her fellows would learn her true identity, learn what she had done before she'd come to accept their outlook on the way the galaxy's sapient species should determine their destinies. When they learned who she was, they would reject her, and they would probably kill her. Until then, she'd do whatever she could to keep them alive, to help them win. Soon, she'd confess all to her commander, Wedge Antilles, and he'd use her knowledge to help bring Zinj to ruin. Soon, she shook away these distracting thoughts and forced herself to listen to her commander's words. Wedge said,
"Now, the Wraiths have a general agenda. Acquire information on what Zinj might be doing at Bin Ring Biomedical on Safanuri."
The third meteor shower in as many days peppered the frozen Arctic regions of Safanuri's northern hemisphere. And then there were the fabricated objects in their midst. Starfighters, almost 24, maneuvered away from the true meteorites and pulled up sharply from their descent, missing collisions with the ground, sometimes by only a few dozen meters. Donos kept his focus on the sensors. He'd proven that he had the reflexes, the technical grounding necessary to become a pilot. He'd risen quickly and surely through the ranks, earning his lieutenancy within a year, being granted the temporary rank of brevet captain soon afterward. His own command, Talon Squadron. Every member except Donos killed in the ambush on an uninhabited world no one wanted. He'd lost 11 subordinates, fellow pilots, some of them friends. He'd lost his command. He'd even lost his mind, or at least misplaced it for a time. His new squadmates had lured him back to reality, had forced him to look once again at life, to begin thinking again about his present, about his future. He returned his attention to his sensors. There would be no future if he plowed into a hillside. All right, then. There were two paths open to him, assuming he didn't get killed before he could begin to follow them. First was the one that had dominated his thinking ever since Talon's squadron had died. For months, he'd considered resigning his commission altogether so he could devote his life to tracking down the individuals who had destroyed his squadron. Of course, two of the most important conspirators behind the destruction of Talon's squadron were already dead. Lieutenant Gara Pettifell, the Imperial Intelligence agent who had provided the data for that operation, had died on Admiral Trigget's star destroyer Implacable, and Trigget had died soon after, trying to escape in a TIE interceptor, brought down by Donos himself. But others had to have been involved. There were plenty more conspirators who needed to die. Yet, part of him no longer wanted to be the instrument of that death. An ever-growing part of him wanted to live a normal life. And that led to his second choice, the one he'd been toying with ever since he had recovered from his collapse. Stay in Starfighter Command and try to rebuild his career, regain his respectability, renew his life. And now, he checked his sensor board for Wraith 2. There she was, toward the head of their formation, tucked in neatly behind Wraith 1, Lara Notso. For the little amount of time they'd shared, she occupied a lot of his thinking. Her intelligence and her beauty drew him. And her secrecy. She seemed adrift, cut off from her past, yet having no apparent idea how to navigate toward her future. He understood that part of her. Felt tremendous sympathy. They were so alike. Yet, that would mean nothing if neither one of them did anything about it. She might not even be aware of how he felt, of what he was thinking.
"She isn't aware," an inner voice told him, "and she's not going to be. Don't foul up her life the way you fouled up your own. Hunt down your enemies. Settle the accounts of your pilots."
But What if he could offer her as much life, as much of a future, as he thought she could offer him? That would mean doing something harder than he'd ever done before. He might just have to forgive himself for letting his pilots die. He might just have to initiate a conversation with a young woman who was suddenly important to him. The X-wings and size of Rogue and Wraith Squadron landed on a spot only 70 meters in diameter. Without repulsor lifts, they could never have all landed upon it. But Rogue Squadron and Wraith Squadron arrayed themselves precisely in neat rows and columns. As the pilots scrambled out of their cockpits under the sliver of a moon, Wedge said, "Get those camouflage covers out. Transfer any fuel remaining from the auxiliary tanks into the interceptors. I want us blanketed down and out of sight in 10 minutes. We have dawn in less than an hour." Once he had the camo covers tied down over his X-wing, Donos sought out Lara. He found her under her own camouflage cover, kneeling on the starboard S-foils of her snub fighter, whispering to her R2 unit, Tonin. He waited patiently until she emerged and extended a hand to help her down. Could I have a word with you? He asked. He led her into the deeper shadow between her X-wing and a TIE interceptor. "There's something I wanted you to think about."
"What's that?"
"Me." She gave him a mocking look. "Rebel pilots have the biggest egos in all the known universe." "Well, it's not like that. I'm asking out of a sense of fairness, since I'm spending all this time thinking about you." Her smile faded. "Min, I'm not amused." "Good. I'm not trying to amuse you. Look, I just spent a long time working up the nerve to bring this up with you at all. It was harder than almost anything I've done, so don't be amused. Take it seriously." She took a step back from him, bringing her up against the wing array of the interceptor. No, just turn around and go find someone else to be interested in. I'm not right for you. I'm a mess. I'm barely fit to fly."
"Me too. We make a perfect couple."
If I don't get killed, I'm sure my career is going to crater," she said. "I'm going to be a tremendous embarrassment to the race."
"How about that? Me too. Another thing we have in common."
When he looked at Lara's face again, though, something had changed. There was a stillness to her, a watchfulness that was almost reptilian. He suppressed an urge to step away. "I could say 12 words, Lara said. "And when I was done, the very least you'd do is turn away and leave me alone forever." Donos could tell that she was speaking the truth, and the fact that she had the power to do this, to send him away, dismayed him.
"Then don't say them."
Donos had really only meant to let her know of his interest, perhaps to rattle her, but she now looked so distant and lost that he couldn't just let her be. He put his arms around her and drew her to him. When her lips met his, they were clenched tight, and she was shaking. But then she relaxed into the kiss. Her arms snaked up around his neck. She made a noise that was part wail, and only he could hear it. There she was, suddenly part of him, and he wondered how he'd ever lived so long without her being there. She drew back her head, her remoteness gone, her expression a little curious, a little anxious.
"That's more like it," he said, and realized immediately that it was the wrong thing to say. She gave him a look he could only imagine her normally offering to someone pouring paint into her X-Wing's engines.
"Thanks," she said, "for reminding me what a gas bag of ego you are." She spun and walked away from him at a fast stride.
Oh, well, considering how badly he usually did with people, that hadn't gone poorly at all.
Donos sighed and headed back to his snub fighter, resisting the urge to whistle.
Under cover of darkness, the crew of black-clad wraiths emerged. Chala Neltran, the squadron's expert in unarmed combat and its newest lieutenant, scanned the darkened bin-ring buildings through a set of holorecording macrobinoculars.
"Downward-facing holocams with overlapping coverage. Standard placement. For Imperial forces, that is overkill for a pharmaceutical fabrications plant."
"All right," Faith said. "We're going in by the high road."
Minutes later, they stood atop a near warehouse, one that was, mercifully, far less thoroughly defended than their target. It was also one story taller than the Binring building, which would work in their favor. Kel Taner, the Wraith's mechanics and demolitions expert, spent a few minutes mounting a device which looked something like a small projectile cannon at the edge of the roof. He slowly pulled the trigger, and it made a noise like a protracted sneeze as it launched a missile across the street, dragging a length of black fiber rope behind it. There was the faintest sound of a metallic clank atop the Binring building. Then a motor started up in the gun and drew the fiber rope taut. Shala clipped two devices to the cable, sleeve housings with handlebars hanging from them.
Crawler ready to go.
One after another, they took the crawler across, each Wraith settling in a crouch on the far roof. By the time Face arrived, Lara, Shala, and Kel had already examined their surroundings for accesses and other sensors, and found some.
Standard roof hatches at intervals, Kel said, and infrared beams. Just over there? He pointed. On the roof over there. We'll need to leave Lara, one of the sets of infra-goggles so she can get through the beams.
Leave her yours, Face instructed. We'll rely on 4 and her set when we're in. Once they were assembled, Face directed Kel to disable security on the nearest roof access. Flight Officer Tyria Sarkin led the descent. The halls were empty, sanitary, smelling faintly antiseptic. All the Wraiths could hear was the distant hum of air-moving machinery and their own faint footsteps. Through a large double door, they entered a circular chamber filled with equipment, panels, consoles, and terminals arrayed in a circle around some sort of large chair. The chair was obviously intended for medical usage. It featured brackets to fit around wrist and ankle and was festooned with equipment on armatures, injectors, view screens, racks filled with bottles.
2 to 6. Do not acknowledge. Additional security on roof suggests this site is prepared for your arrival. Check for new modifications to your surroundings. 2 out.
Alarm signal,
a technician said. His voice was unnaturally shrill. Dr. Gass blinked and looked around. The 4 walls of Binring Biomedical's control room were occupied by banks of terminals, each dedicated to a different area of coverage.
Doctor,
said another technician, they're in the first chamber.
He put through the holocam feed to one of her terminals.
Gass looked at the screen and frowned.
They got through our outer perimeter.
Captain Nippers, her new intelligence specialist on loan from Warlord Zinge, leaned over her shoulder.
They're pretty good, but they're here, so they're dead.
Dia and Shala covered the door with their blasters. The others looked at the equipment in the chamber.
I know that chair,
Piggy said.
I solved math problems there while the front door while being electrocuted.
Charming, Face said. Then Face felt the floor give way beneath him. All around him, Wraiths and equipment dropped. Awkwardly, he rolled to his back. The floor of the room above had split down the middle. Hinges to either side had allowed it to open like a door, dropping them what looked like a fall of 6 or 7 meters. And now stormtroopers were lining up at the edges of the room above. They aimed their blasters down at the Wraiths. One called out,
throw up your demolitions gear or we open fire.
Kel turned to Shala and said,
do what they say, demolitions.
Shala didn't hesitate. She shucked off her own pack, which contained her infra-goggles, spare glow rods, and preserved food, and hurled it up to the stormtroopers above. The speaker caught the bag. The ceiling began to close.
What are you doing?
Face asked. In 30 seconds, they'll know we've lied. They'll open it up and start shooting.
In 30 seconds, we're supposed to be dead,
Kel said. He pulled off his own pack and rummaged around in its contents. Take a look around. You know what this place is? The floor was some sort of grating. The walls were heavy, dark metal with a tight grid of nozzles protruding from them. As Face looked, the floor grating beside the walls began glowing red. The redness quickly spread toward the center of the room.
I burn organic material here,
Piggy said. He struggled to his feet, holding his side.
It's an incinerator.
Kel held 2 charges, 1 in each hand. He tucked 1 charge into a pocket and tapped something into the keypad of the other.
and flames erupted from every nozzle along the chamber walls. The flames were no more than half a meter in length, but the temperature in the room rose instantly. Several wraiths swore, and all flinched away from the new heat. 3 seconds to detonation, Kelp said. Find cover.